Hello, I'm Eric Jansen. You're tuned to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. This week, reflections on queer life in Israel and on same-sex couples law there and here. My guest is internationally recognized expert on gay and lesbian relationship law. He's the co-author of NOLO's Making It Legal, a guide to same-sex marriage, domestic partnerships, and civil unions, operates the website samesexlaw.com, and for many years has been a lawyer here in the Bay Area, providing legal counsel to same-sex partners on the formation and dissolution of their relationships. He also serves as a mediator and arbitrator in same-sex breakups, especially in matters involving real estate. He spent the first half of this year in Israel teaching a course on U.S. same-sex relationship law at the Strix College of Law near Tel Aviv. He's been featured on Out in the Bay at least twice before, keeping us up to date on the many twists and turns in same-sex legal issues here. Frederick Hertz, welcome back to Out in the Bay.
Great to be here.
Fred, I know you'd visited Israel before this year, but now you're just back from 6 months working there, teaching Israelis about legal issues for gay men and lesbians here. So if you could first just give us a sort of a broad brush picture of what queer life is like there now. How has it changed since your previous visits, or what your impressions are now that you've had a chance to, you know, really immerse yourself in life there in and around Tel Aviv?
Well, the first thing to know is that there really are two Israels. There is what some people would call modern Israel, other people would call the real Israel. And that's places like Tel Aviv and Haifa and parts of places like Beersheba. And then there is the other Israel, which from a Jewish perspective is kind of like closer to being in Poland in the 18th century and or otherwise in the Middle East, which are the areas of religiously Orthodox Israel or Arab Israel, such as Nazareth, or the occupied territories. So my experience was really about the 50 to 60 to 70% of Israel that is modern Israel that's centered in Tel Aviv. And what's most surprising is how totally hip, modern, rich, and gay friendly it is. My grocery store I went to, it was a totally ordinary experience to see gay couples standing in line in front of me with their two kids. Of course, one of the parents was always on the cell phone while he was shopping and trying
it's
to
take... not too unlike here, right?
Right, and trying to take care of their kids. The Gay Pride March was huge. It was popular. It's also 85 degrees, and you have a lot of gorgeous guys without wearing many clothes, so that's nice. And it's totally hip and accepting. Legally, gay couples have more rights in Israel than they have in California. So it's a pretty welcoming place.
So how is it that they have more rights there than in California?
Well, several things have happened. One is that in terms of issues of discrimination or benefits, the courts have been very favorable to gay claimants. I think something like 15 out of 16 cases have gone for the gay plaintiffs. So through court action, not generally through legislation, but through court action, gay claimants have won around employment benefits, around immigration benefits, around adoption. Just about everything that is looked for here is obtained there. One thing to keep in mind is, like, unlike the United States, there aren't 50 different state legal systems. There is only one. So you only have to win in one court, and then you've won. The other area, and it's the area that's the most complicated to explain to people, is that gay couples have almost as many rights as married couples, but they have them as cohabiting couples, not as married couples. So if you look at marriage as the indicator, Israel is way, way, way in the back seat. But if you look at the civil rights that gay couples have as cohabiting couples, they actually have just about all the rights that American couples have, including the federal ones that American couples don't have.
Well, you explained to me in an email you sent me a while ago that Israel does not allow civil marriage for anyone. So,
right.
And what's the effect of that?
Well, let's just back up here a second. So first of all, the U.S. supposedly has civil marriage, even though we let priests and ministers officiate. Israel's probably the only modern country that is actually not a theocracy, unlike Iran and other places, but there's a very strong Jewish religious influence and Arab Muslim religious influence. And as a result of a complicated history, the personal status matters of birth, marriage, divorce, and death are handled by religious organizations. For Muslims, it's the Muslim court, the Sharia court. For Jews, it's the Rabbanut, the rabbinical court. Christians have their own. So as a result of that, marriage can only be officiated and only entered into by a under the auspices of a religious organization. And follows from that, there can be no interfaith marriage, because how can an interfaith couple get a religious marriage? So there is no civil marriage in Israel. And as a result, there have been two ways that couples have gotten around this restriction, because a lot of couples don't qualify. There are interfaith couples. There are people who may be half Jewish. There are all sorts of problems. They've gotten around them in two ways. One is going out of the country and marrying, i.e. to Cyprus or to Canada or to Romania. And the second is simply to live together unmarried. And because of those practices, the civil law system recognizes foreign heterosexual marriages and grants marital rights to cohabiting couples. And in a series of court rulings, again through the court, not through legislature, the courts have ruled that cohabiting gay couples and lesbian couples should be treated just like cohabiting straight couples and thus have all the rights.
So what are the rights that say, for example, an interfaith non-gay couple has compared to a married couple that's married through a religious institution?
So an interfaith couple, or it could also be a secular couple that doesn't want a religious marriage,
okay,
that goes out of country and marries, the rights they have, they're half a dozen of them. There are things like there are certain pension survivor rights, especially for children, that depend on marriage. Also, if your partner is not Jewish and you want to immigrate, the path to citizenship is somewhat easier if you're married as opposed to cohabiting. Mind you, a partner of a immigrant or Israeli partner of an Israeli citizen can stay in Israel, can work in Israel. There's some delays about getting citizenship. So those are a few areas. Also, if there is a divorce, there is a special civil divorce court, especially for interfaith couples who aren't eligible for religious divorce. Israeli courts haven't figured out whether they can give divorces to overseas married gay couples. So there are half a dozen areas, but they're quite small.
So basically speaking, whether it's a gay couple that's cohabitating or a straight couple that's cohabitating because they're not married for whatever reason, they have essentially the same rights as a Jewish couple that's married.
Absolutely. Now, I don't want to minimize the fact that there are two groups for whom this is still a real problem. One is there are some political groups that are deeply offended by the inability to marry. And because of this whole civil religious split, most gay and lesbian couples don't want to get married because it's religious. But there are some for whom this is a very offensive area of discrimination. The second area, of course, is that there is an emerging group of religious gays and lesbians for whom the exclusion from religious marriage is deeply, deeply troubling.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. My guest is attorney Frederick Hertz, the co-author of Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships and Civil Unions, and an internationally recognized expert on same-sex legal issues. He's been teaching a course on U.S. gay relationship law at the Strix College of Law in Israel. And we're talking about what he taught and what he's learned about queer life in Israel. So, Fred, I'm curious to know why Strix College of Law hired you to teach this course. Why do law students there want or need to know about what's going on here in the U.S.?
Well, first of all, the legal territory for gays and lesbians in Israel is quite dynamic. There are courses in gay couples law internationally and domestically at most of the law schools. There are gay student organizations at most of the law schools. Even Hebrew University, in the most religious place of Jerusalem, has a gay students group and is planning to do a gay legal clinic. And the interest in international law is very strong there. Lots of Israelis go to work for American companies. A lot of people move here. So there's a great deal of interest in the topic. In this small law school that I taught at, for example, there are no fewer than three professors whose main focus is international and domestic aspects of same-sex couples law. The leading book on same-sex law couples internationally is written by an Israeli law professor. So there's a great deal of interest. From the students' point of view, I would say they were more interested in the politics, in family law, and the reason I was invited to teach there actually was a slightly different angle, which is that they require their students to take a class that focuses on the details of American law as an introduction to American law, and gay couples law is a fascinating way to learn that. If you study Proposition 8, for example, you could have an entire course on the American legal system.
Sure.
State law, federal law, propositions. So the class was as much about the mechanics of American law as it was gay couples. So it was both.
So what kind of questions were the main ones that came up for you from students there about gay and lesbian rights here?
Well, the first area of confusion, which almost anybody outside of the United States asks, is how can you have this craziness of different laws based on different states? They all know the American geography. They know that people move from Chicago to New York to Los Angeles, and that companies work internationally and nationally. And so there was complete bafflement as to why you would have a marriage valid in New York but not in Pennsylvania, or why you would have an adoption valid in Washington, D.C., but not in Virginia, just 5 miles away. The, I would say, stupidity of that situation really was, first of all, legally very confusing to my students and from a political point of view, very unusual. The other part that I think they had the confusion about was the focus on marriage, because for most secular folks in Israel, marriage is not all that important. And so the focus on marriage seemed very odd to them. And then I would say that the last piece of it was a confusion about our approach to democracy. When we had the class on Proposition 8 and I talked about the election, people were just astounded that you would let, I don't want to say dumb citizens, but ordinary citizens vote on such an important thing. In Israel, you would never put that to a public vote. The idea is that your legislators are intelligent, competent people who can make decisions.
Judges, that's why we voted for them. That's why we hired them.
Exactly. Judges are intelligent, wise people who make decisions. Why would you submit this to a popular vote? They found that totally impossible to believe.
Right. You mentioned before we started recording that parenting is a huge deal here. Is parenting more of a route to lesbian and gay relationship rights, you know, than just living together or getting the same rights as unmarried, child-free straight couples have?
Yes, and not only rights, but acceptance. If you take the rhetoric here about marriage as dignity, marriage as validity, marriage as showing societal approval of relationships, in Israel, it's all about child rearing. In Israel, especially within the Jewish community, child rearing is seen as a public duty. Mm-hmm. It's rebuilding the 6 million who died in the Holocaust. It's, I'll say this in a touchy way, it's maintaining the demographic advantage over non-Jews. And family life is so much closer there than here. Partly it's geographically closer. It's also socially closer. People spend every Friday night with their parents, regardless if they're gay, straight, or trans. It's a small country, and you do that. There is a very strong network of extended family, and what my gay friends tell me is that up until about 5 or 6 years ago, gay people got a pass. Lesbians were still expected to have babies, but gay men were not expected to have kids. well, the gay exemption is over. And, you know, as everyone says, they've seen on TV about surrogates. And so it's having kids that is the entree into mainstream Israeli society. And it's an entree that an overwhelmingly large percentage of gay men, especially younger gay men, very much want.
So now that they've seen it's possible, it's expected. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Although we should talk about the difficulties that gay couples face.
Well, let's go ahead.
So Israel, it is almost impossible to adopt a child in Israel, gay or straight. There are very few children eligible for adoption. Israel does not allow cross-faith adoption. They actually think it's unhealthy for children to be raised outside of their natural community. And there's free abortion on demand, so there's very few children available for adoption. In the past, most gay men raised children by co-parenting with a straight or lesbian single woman. There were organizations that matched gay men with women. These children were raised by a couple that was open about being a non-romantic couple. They would typically live upstairs, downstairs, or next door, and they would co-parent. Now, it happens here. We have Bevan Dufty, and we have thousands of others, but it really was a norm in a way that's different than here. Starting about 3 or 4 years ago, gay couples started to hire surrogates. Now, one of the residues of the religious influence on law in Israel is that surrogacy is not available to gay men in Israel. Surrogacy is only available now for heterosexual couples. So gay couples have had to go to India or to the United States or to Eastern Europe to hire surrogates, which is very expensive. And there is now a lawsuit to try to undo that barrier. But at the moment, the majority of gay couples having kids do it through hiring surrogates overseas.
You mentioned that family is very strong there and that the outlying areas outside of Tel Aviv are not particularly friendly to gay folks. So what about the folks who move into the city? Because it's a smaller country, they have more problems getting away from family like we do here.
You can't get away. You're never more than 3 or 4 hours away. But you can move away, and you can move to Tel Aviv. The problem is in some ways similar to, if you could imagine, a gay kid from Hollister or Bakersfield moving to San Francisco. It's expensive. It's competitive. The education system that people have often doesn't equip them to get jobs. And also Israel works through a lot of informal networks, through friends, through family. And so if your family isn't in the Tel Aviv area and you don't have a partner, it can be very isolating for you. So what I see happening, I've heard happening, is that guys come, and this happens to women as well, they come to Tel Aviv, they get a job, it doesn't last, they go back home to their angry homophobic parents in the small towns, then they try to find a boyfriend somewhere, and there's a kind of ricocheting back and forth that can be very difficult. I should also point out that as wealthy as Israel has become, it's become a very stratified society economically, again, much in the way of San Francisco is. Housing is extremely expensive. A lot of the jobs don't pay particularly high salaries. And so if you come from a small town or a rural area, or especially if you're Arab, it can be a very lonely, hard time trying to make it in the big city.
Now, you mentioned, speaking of Arabs, that it was like gay Palestinians have also moved to Tel Aviv. And there was quite a flap recently at the Frameline Gay and Lesbian Film Festival here in San Francisco where there was a protest about pinkwashing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the situation is that gays and lesbians who live in Israel, who are Israeli citizens, are free to live anywhere in Israel. And while they may be treated second class within Israel, they are still citizens with democratic rights. The greater problem are the gays and lesbians who live in the occupied territories or Gaza, who do not have the right anymore to work in Israel. Ever since the Second Intifada, the wall has basically been closing off people from Ramallah or Hebron, and they're not allowed to come into Israel. And many of them find their home environment very repressive. While there isn't a criminal issue of being homosexual, most families are very traditional. Most environments are very traditional. The West Bank and Gaza are not welcoming for out gays and lesbians. So that leaves them with two very painful alternatives. One is to stay where they are and either live in the closet or get married or endure a lot of problems, or come illegally into Israel, where, unfortunately, they're not allowed to get refugee or asylum status because technically they are coming from a place that is, in effect, an enemy nation of Israel. So they end up living underground, often engaged in criminal activity, sometimes recruited by the Secret Service to rat on their Palestinian friends in exchange for not being deported, or working as sex workers. And what the wonderful film Invisible Men talked about were the stories of three such men who actually were able to get asylum in Northern Europe with the help of an immigration clinic at Tel Aviv University. Ironically, as they're being helped by that Israeli law clinic, they're also being deported by the Israeli police. So one of the things that was so good about the film is it showed there were some very helpful Israelis and there were some very harmful Israelis.
Okay, and so... And is that a typical situation for Palestinian gays?
Well, you know, one of the problems is because of the politics, which ties into the whole pinkwashing issue, we don't know what's typical. I've heard there are 600 to 700 gays living underground in Tel Aviv. No one really knows what the conditions are in Ramallah. The gay organizations there will not speak to press at all. There is a quite understandable hostility to the Israeli or Jewish curiosity about gays because of this pinkwashing issue.
So what do you know about this? I don't know, want to get too much into this incident at the film festival, but the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival here has been criticized in the past, or at least there's been protests in the past for why are they showing films from Israel at all? And it's, I guess, a pro-Palestinian group that is making these protests.
Yes, what's happened is there are two sets of problems. One is very legitimate concerns for Israeli treatment of Arab Palestinians within Israel and the situation with the occupation and the settlements. There is also a complicated interaction, which is that the Israeli government has been touting its gay friendliness, especially in places like San Francisco and New York, in ways that appear to be strategic publicity to try to soften the criticism of Israel, especially in gay-friendly environments, by saying, hey, before you attack us so much, look at the way we treat our gay people compared to how they're treated in Ramallah or, heaven forbid, Saudi Arabia. So the use of Israel's gay friendliness in this propagandistic way has only heightened the intensity of the criticism of places like Frameline, because the perception is that by showing this film that does show Israelis treating these Palestinians well, although even though I said there are some Israelis that don't treat them well, that the Frameline is furthering the goals of the Israeli government. That's what the controversy was about. And what I find unfortunate, and I heard a presentation by the director when the film was shown in Tel Aviv and these very questions were asked, is that this political framework where if you're an Israeli doing something that shows something gay positive, you're immediately accused of being part of the government's pinkwashing machine, whereas this filmmaker very genuinely felt he was showing the good and the bad, both of Israelis and Palestinians, and he was very glad that the film was being shown and found it very troubling that here was someone who was trying to show a very neutral image of things, not government propaganda. The Israeli government does not come across looking good in that film.
Right.
So he was distressed that this film got swallowed into that political conflict.
The name of the film, again, is The Invisible Men, and it won the juried award for Best Documentary at this year's Frameline SF International LGBT Film Festival, so it comes highly recommended. We just have a few minutes left, so I want to move on quickly and ask you anything about the latest on U.S. laws. We know it keeps changing all the time. Obama recently said he was, supports gay marriage, and you said that brought some questions from your students in Israel.
Yeah, one of my students the week after that said, "So I hear gay marriage is legal in the United States now." And I looked at him saying, "Oh, is there something I didn't hear?" And he just said, "Well, your president said that that's what should happen. So doesn't that just happen as of course?" A matter of course. It doesn't, unfortunately. But the good news is that the number of courts that have ruled that the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional is growing. We've had numerous trial court rulings now. We even have a court of appeals ruling. So that issue of the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act may be coming to the U.S. Supreme Court within the next year if they take the case, which I think they will. So that's happening. And then on the Proposition 8 front, things have moved very slowly, and we now have a full panel review by the Ninth Circuit, and that is going to delay that decision for about a year or so. We have actually a vote coming up in November in Minnesota on the constitutionality issue. And the last piece we have is lawsuits filed in Nevada and Illinois challenging the ban on marriage, and those are states like California, which have a marriage equivalent domestic partnership. And the question is, if you're giving gay couples marital rights, why are you denying them the stigma of, why are you stigmatizing them by denying them the status of marriage?
So you're about to go off again somewhere else, or are you going to be back here working in the trenches again about the realities of same-sex relationship law here in the States?
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to be traveling in the month of August, back in September, working on formation and dissolution issues, and actually doing something that seemed to be appreciated in Israel quite a bit, which is talking to people about the realities of getting married and getting divorced and not just focused on the politics.
Very good. Thank you very much. I want to thank my guest, same-sex law expert attorney Frederick Hertz, author of Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions, published by NOLO. And he just returned from 6 months in Israel teaching about U.S. gay relationship law at Strix College of Law in Israel. You can learn more about Frederick Hertz and his book at his website, samesexlaw.com. That's samesexlaw.com. I also want to give a quick thank to a couple of Out in the Bay underwriting supporters. Safeway for its donation of water and nuts to the recent San Francisco Front Runners Pride Run, which benefited Out in the Bay, and the Safeway Foundation for its financial support of Out in the Bay, Safeway, Ingredients for Life. And Catherine Holland, realtor in Coldwell Banker's Castor District office on Market Street. She may be queer, but she'll get your deal straight. That's Catherine with a K as in Katharine Hepburn, KatharineHolland.com. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KALW, our host station, for studio use and airtime. If you missed part of this broadcast, you can hear the whole thing on our website, OutinTheBay.com, where you can also sign up for free podcasts and get the Stitcher app that lets you hear radio programs on mobile devices. We've been producing Out in the Bay for coming up on 8 years this October. We love your words of encouragement. We could use your financial support as well. It's easy and tax deductible on our website, outinthebay.com. Just hit the Donate Now button and make a contribution, big or small. And don't forget matching funds from your employer. You'll find info when you click through to the Donate button. WY Enterprises maintains our website, outinthebay.com, services for your life and your business. Our theme music was composed and performed by San Francisco musician Holly Ann Mead. Learn more about Holly on her blog, hollymead.tumblr.com. We'd love to hear from you with segment suggestions, general comments, and questions. So write to us, Eric at outinthebay.com and Marilyn at outinthebay.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening.